right, man, this is a full day of news. We got to get Tom in here. Yesterday, he seemed a little low energy. I was concerned about him. Tommy? Check his temperature. Hang on. Oh, the old double door open. Wow. Coming through the double Dutch door there, Tom. How are you?
I'm pretty darn good, John. And right. You?
Fine. And you?
Fantastically attractive, are you?
I don't know if this is another reference to Donald Trump smiling more. I can't quite tell what's going on. Diving in now! All right. A little caught off guard, Tom. You seem
you haven't read deep into our
looks.
Show.
Okay.
It has something to do with your favorite guy.
Who's that?
Rudy Giuliani.
What about Rudy Giuliani? I didn't watch that episode. Did you watch the episode with Rudy Giuliani and his hands in his pants and the girl? Did you watch that already?
No, I just read about it.
Oh, okay.
He claimed that she wasn't fantastically attractive or anything.
We will get to that story later.
Exactly.
But speaking of fantastically attractive. Non-discriminatory way. Nothing that human resources would be upset about. All right, Hannah, how are you?
I am great. How are you?
Are we going to have you for two segments? Are you going to do both the vaccine and then also talk about the council's going to do about homelessness?
I am. Yes, sir.
Okay, good.
Why not?
All right.
It's my
Which one
you
want,
no.
What do you want to do first? Which one you do?
I'm going to say let's go ahead and start with the navigation team, even though I know that Jacob didn't want to just because I was late getting him my vaccine sound.
Okay.
I'm jamming. I just got off the press conference, so we'll start
That's
the other
right.
way.
All right, so go hit it. When it comes to the navigation team.
Okay, so we know that in the 2020 rebalancing package that the city council, that was for the rest of this year, they had eliminated the funding for the navigation team, so the mayor had them stop doing all of their work for the rest of this year. And there was a lot of people criticizing that, what are we doing? Those are the people who do the outreach and go engage with people out in the homeless encampments and get them into shelters. But it's controversial because on the other side, you've got people who complain that armed police officers are going and sweeping the camps and all of that. So Councilmember Andrew Lewis had a plan, and he announced that the other day.
To stand up the Unsheltered Outreach and Response Team, which will be the city's central coordinating team to empower and collaborate with the outreach efforts of our contracted providers.
Now, here's the idea.
This new team that would be in HSD is focused on building on and empowering that tradition of centering outreach and community providers first. This team will not be authorized for in-field outreach. That'll be the exclusive purview of our community-based outreach providers. It goes without saying that this team will be exclusively civilian. The city practice of using armed and uniformed police as agents of homelessness outreach and coordination is resolutely over.
So that was the big thing, right? Because that's the big controversy. The majority of the people on the council right now don't want to see, if not maybe all of them at this point, don't want to see the armed police officers out there sweeping the encampments, and as you know, we've heard the complaints for several years, and the council just has more support for that than they have in years past. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there are a lot of other, and I think I wrote this in my article, there are Snohomish County has a somewhat similar model where they have their sheriffs with embedded social workers who go out and engage with people, build those relationships over and over every day in these encampments so that they eventually can kind of coax them into getting some services going into shelter. Those social workers aren't going to go out there by themselves because it can be dangerous if you deal with someone who's in crisis or addicted to drugs or whatever the case may be. So that's some of the concern, what I'm hearing from this. But Andrew Lewis seems to think he's got it covered. They'll take a vote on Monday.
Doesn't Snohomish do the we'll come back for you, we'll give you a choice, you either get into a program or we put you in jail? Do they still do that sort of carrot stick thing?
Parts of it. That is if I'm not mistaken, going to be a Marysville-specific plan.
Yeah.
Although I think Snohomish County Sheriff Adam Fortney might have tuned the whole county one up that way after the fact as well. But there's also the legislature is looking. Last year they gave grants. I can't remember where to start a similar program somewhere else in the state. And they're looking to do that again more this year, again, teaming the law enforcement in case they're necessary with those social workers. But
yeah.
Andrew Lewis's plan is based, I think, largely on this model that they had in Oregon. But the important thing here, too, is that this is just for the end of the year. They're kind of coordinating with the mayor's office, and you heard the police chief talk about that in Heather's newscast. It's a whole nother battle for 2021. We'll have to see what happens.
And I'm curious about the dynamics between the city council and the mayor and Andrew Lewis. Andrew Lewis was not one of the ones voting to defund. Was he one of the two, or was he? I'm trying to figure out which side of the council split was Andrew Lewis, that he's managing to be the bridge.
Andrew, he's managed to be the bridge. He tends to kind of be in the middle, the voice of reason, but he got hammered before from the community, before the protest community, I should say, before that vote on the 2020 rebalancing budget, because he had said one thing early on, then he kind of switched and took
Didn't
it back.
Didn't they go to his house and scream at him in the middle of the night? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and all the public comment at city council was literally directed right at him. But, you know, he is learning, and he was moved to change his mind. So,
that's good.
But it was Juarez and Peterson, by the way, Tom, were the ones who had voted against it then.
Okay. What credibility does Lewis have? The credibility of the, let's say, the more progressive side of the city council, and has the mayor's office on his side that this is a compromise that's going to happen?
I don't know that I would say that the mayor's on his side. What I got from the mayor's office on this was that, you know, there's a big job ahead of us in deciding how this is going to go in 2021. And they also said that the mayor believes at this point that there's always going to be that possibility that when you're clearing a hazardous encampment, you're going to need to have a police presence. They don't necessarily have to be a part of the navigation team, but they might be there. And that's what's going to have to be hashed out for 2021. I think they'll probably pass this on Monday just to get through the end of the year.
Gotcha. Makes
sense. So put in perspective for you, this time they have swept seven camps. This time last year they had swept 470 camps. The only way they will actually get in there is if they deem it to be extremely dangerous, or some point of like to the public health, like TB or something like that. So they will allow these things to continue to flourish and grow. They seem to, it looks like they've got a Windermere sign out in front of some of them that they're selling a spot to be able to move in. They didn't like
because
it. They
of
don't
the
like
pandemic.
The police going in. Right. They don't like the police going in. They didn't like them sweeping because they basically just kicked them down the road to go somewhere else. I talked to a cop friend of mine, and he was explaining he's not part of that group, but he's part of another group that knows that group. He said a lot of the people in there are running from the cops. They have warrants. They are armed. They are angry. They are dangerous. He said, I can't imagine one social worker wanting to walk into one of those camps. I'd ask Mr. Lewis to go into one of those camps during the day or night. Just walk in there and see if he feels safe walking in. Certainly without a police officer, they could get you, rob you, kill you, stab you, rape you, do whatever they want to you in these encampments. This is what happens within that environment. So the city is going to let it go. The only way they'll knock them down or move them out is if it's extremely dangerous. If you're a citizen, you will call a number and you'll complain, and then they will write your number down and your complaint down, and they may or may not do what, Hannah? Do we have any idea?
They may or may not sweep you if you have a complaint.
Neighbor, yeah. Like Ballard. Have you seen Ballard recently?
Yes,
have you been over to Ballard? That's quite the complex they've been able to build, right?
Yes. No, it's huge. It looks like, it is, yeah. And there's no one right now, so that's the deal. Until they pass this thing, they've got, you know, your reach and your other community outreach groups that tend to contact with the city. They are still out there doing the outreach, but they're not going to go on their own and clear a camp.
Yeah. How about Denny Park? That's very pretty, Denny Park's.
Oh.
So can people go in and use Denny Park? Like, could a mom and dad go in there with their kid and throw the ball around, you think?
You could try, but I'm pretty sure that's where the guy with the stick that was on fire was, right, the other day, who took that flaming stick and put it in the police car. But it's not, I wouldn't know.
Oh, so mom, dad, kid, a ball, and a guy's got a bat. Unfortunately, the bat's on fire. I guess the stick is the bat. Okay, I got it.
Just to clarify, though, John, one of the reasons why there have been so few encampments is because once COVID hit, they all decided backing off because it was a CDC call that said, listen, to disperse these homeless camps could be worse for the spread of COVID than not. So
yes.
The city has backed off on that score, too.
Right. And the mayor's, there's also a bunch more shelter. They did a lot in the city and at the county level as soon as the pandemic hit to try to bring people inside. That, you know, they did all the hotel room units, and now they're trying to ramp that up both at the county and the city level. So there's been a lot of that. But they're here in the last, I don't know, month and a half or so, there's definitely more people out on the streets. And then remember, during the whole CHOP process, there was all of Cal Anderson was a homeless camp, essentially.
Homeless, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, okay. Let's. You want to do the other one, or are you still to you know, poke a finger in Jake's eye?
No, we're good. And Tom wants to know about vaccines. So, the Department of Health, State Department of Health just did their weekly update, and they had earlier put out this plan. It's a very rough working living plan, as I think what she said. It was something they had to turn into the CDC, and they did that Friday. Michelle Roberts, she's the Assistant Secretary of State, and she talked a little about it this afternoon.
Our team is laying the groundwork for distributing a vaccine once it's available with the goal of hopefully saving lives and reducing disease transmission. We're not starting from scratch. We're relying on a strong infrastructure, a vaccine distribution that's already in place. Right now, we already distribute about 3 million doses of vaccines for children and adults every year in partnership with about 1,200 providers across the state. So we're starting from that. There's a lot more work to do for COVID, but we're building on the experience and existing infrastructure around vaccines to guide our work and build out these bigger plans.
And they're also going to do a ton of community outreach.
The plan itself outlines the specific actions and steps the department will take, like developing equitable vaccine allocation, developing the strong infrastructure with healthcare providers for vaccine distribution and clinical training, how we're going to be tracking vaccine administration data, and how we really need to communicate and learn about the questions and concerns the public may have. So we're ready to answer that and provide information.
And actually, here's where she talks about the outreach.
We're also engaging with different communities and sectors who are at higher risk for getting or spreading COVID disease. So once again, including essential workers, healthcare providers, college students, early learning providers, and parents. We're gathering feedback from these interviews and focus groups and community conversations, and that's what's going to help inform our plans going forward, help us figure out what are the criteria and around equitable distribution. How can we help use that information to continue to figure out how we're sub-prioritize vaccines when there's not enough for everybody who wants to be vaccinated?
And the big question is the cost. The cost of the vaccine.
Wait. Okay. All right. Go ahead.
Do cost. Then we'll come back.
That the federal government has paid for the actual vials of vaccine for a COVID vaccine for now, and have said they have a commitment to making sure that every American who wants the vaccine will be able to get it at no cost. Usually there is healthcare providers, even though they can't charge for the vial of vaccine, they could either charge what's called an administrative fee, which just kind of covers their time and materials for giving it, and potentially an office visit fee. That will be covered by health insurance. Legislation had some language around to make sure that's covered for ACIP recommended vaccines. We still need more information on, is there going to be limits to how much those fees could be?
That's the big question, and they don't know that yet.
Oh, we're running out of time, and there's great stuff here. That's all right. It's going to be rationed. Obviously, they don't have enough, right?
Yeah, it's a phased-in approach. It's going to be rationed, and everything I've heard indicates, you know, your first responders, your frontline medical workers are likely to get it first, along with, you know, important elected types, military, that kind of thing. They're also going to do a big
types.
A big push.
Politicians get it first.
You know, the people who make decisions and whatnot.
Oh yeah, the experts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but there's also going to be a big public campaign to try to build up confidence and trust in the various communities in Washington, because not everybody's going to necessarily want it right away is the concern. So a lot that they're still working on, and, it, you know, we'll have to see how it plays out, whether everybody wants it, doesn't, and how many can get it. I hear right now, widespread availability for everyone, probably not going to happen until summer.
Yeah. Okay, John, do you want to jump in? I mean, yeah, we do have a lot of questions. We've got four.
Yeah,
four
go ahead,
good
fire one
here.
Off, Tom.
So what I'm fascinated by is this idea that so it makes sense allocation of vaccines to high risk workers, to essential workers, to healthcare people, all that nursing homes. I get that. That's perfect. I also am fascinated by this idea that they're going to take an equity lens into consideration, mm-hmm. which I think is important. Right now, Black and Brown communities are hit the hardest by COVID-19. However, I read this fascinating article a few weeks ago that says there is such deep suspicion within the African-American community of doctors and medical types because of the, you know, decades ago history, that there is a higher hesitation in those communities to even take it. Do you know anything about what the hunch is or the sense is about outreach to those communities which are at most risk but also maybe at most suspicious?
They will definitely be the focus of the outreach that she was just talking about today, along with mm-hmm. the essential workers and things like that. But that's part of that equity lens that they're talking about. So I think they will try to educate to make sure, because they really have for months now tried to they've seen these disproportionate outcomes from the pandemic in these communities. And they want to reverse that and make sure they're getting what they need.
Rob, you know what? Let's do this, Hannah. There's so much to talk about on this. Can you stick around?
Sure.
Because this topic, I think, hits everybody. This is not just about Seattle homeless. This idea of rationing, limiting, and then who gets the vaccine and who doesn't get the vaccine. Because, Tom, I know that study that you're talking about, that's from 1991. I read that same study about the concern, and they took it back to the Stigi Airmen, and they said, you know, that wasn't fair. The knowledge of the Stigi Airmen, 17% of whites knew about them. 74% of blacks did. But that's 1971. I don't know if the stigma of that is still hanging in the air. But let's do this. We'll get a quick commercial break. We'll take a traffic break. Sorry, Ms. Taylor. And then we come back, and let's talk more about whether or not we're going to ration this and how they're going to do it. We're too quick. All right, Ms. Taylor, what's it look like on the roads?
Here we go. All righty, everybody. If you need to get yourself a mortgage, I give them out like candy. Get yourself Keel Mortgage. The good people there work hard for you. Keel Mortgage, 1-888-778-KIEL. And I'm talking to everybody that should be wanting to refinance their house and take advantage. Incredibly low, historically low, never been this low, going out of business, lost our lease, everything's got to go. That's your mortgage. That's right. Get yourself a mortgage from Keel Mortgage. Refinance that house. If you're going to stay in it for 5 or 6 years, that's money in your pocket. 1-888-778-KIEL. If you're just joining, Hannah stayed with us. We asked her to stay with us because the first segment, we went and talked about with the navigation team and what they're going to be doing with the homeless. But then even more importantly, I think, is this idea that this vaccine is going to be coming out and that at some point we're going to have to rely upon the experts to determine who gets it and who doesn't get it. An interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal, I don't know if you saw it today, Tom, that the steps that are being taken to transport the vaccines from one location to the next, there will be armed guards, there will be fake trucks, there will be fake boxes with fake vaccines in them. They'll have GPS trackers on them. The vials will have specially coated little tiny pieces of a certain piece of like paper that will be on them that will show up only on black light, certain codes, because they said this stuff is going to be like gold at Fort Knox, that if somebody could get in there, get these things, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 or 10,000, and move them onto a black market or whatever they want to do, they're doing everything they possibly can. Johnson & Johnson, everybody that's got these vaccines, I think there's 6 or 7 that are in the works that are moving forward. So to give you some idea, this is a game changer when they come and then finally be determined. They say only about 100 million, this is Fauci saying, about 100 million vaccines will be available within the first year. The question is, how many are we able to get out? The first batch will be 15 million. So if you have 15 million, who do you give them to? So, Hannah, what we learned or what you learned earlier today is they sort of have an idea of where they want them to go, right?
Right. And again, there's some loose guidance from the feds as to what states should start doing as they start to plan for this. And it's a lot of what we talked about before the break is you need to engage with the community. You need to figure out who exactly it is you're going to prioritize, because really it's expected to be a very limited supply of the vaccine initially. And you have to, I don't see any guidance as to how they're supposed to decide which people are allowed to get it originally. Those, you know, the firefighters, first responders, all of those types are the ones I've heard floated earlier. But I'm also seeing that the federal government is saying their guidance is going to be a little bit different than, say, in the H1N1 pandemic or any influenza pandemic in the past. So I don't see exactly what those are yet. Our state has some leeway to figure that out on their own. We'll have to see what it looks like. But not everybody's going to want it, though, either. It looks like August, maybe half of Americans said that they were going to get it, the COVID vaccine, when it was widely available. The latest poll from a couple of days ago, that's up to about 58%.
Go ahead, John. I was going to say, so half don't think COVID-19 can kill them.
It doesn't say that I can see why they won't get it.
That's what they're assuming. They're saying, well, I'm not going to take a vaccine because I'm not concerned this is going to kill me.
Or the vaccine is suspect. That's the other way.
Right. They don't trust the vaccine. And there's been a big push since the minute the pandemic hit. The anti-vaccination folks in our state have been preparing for when the vaccination is going to be here. You know, there's always worries and rumors about whether it's going to be mandatory, things like that.
Yeah.
And so they've got their own crowds working it as well.
What I was going to say is that Seattle Times, at least, Evan Bush reports there are three phases that the state announced.
First phase,
high-risk workers in healthcare settings, first responders, people with comorbidities, adults in long-term care, other essential workers. Then the second phase, John, would be a broad network of provider settings, pharmacies, community health centers, primary care offices, occupational health clinics. The third phase is when they're going to try to work on boosting confidence in the vaccine and convince people that it's actually going to be worthwhile. So there are like 1,000 pharmacies in Washington State. 90% of them have said that they are interested in getting access to them. So I think it goes to select individuals in sort of essential roles, and then it goes to the broadest dispensation through pharmacies and community care centers.
But then what does that look like, right? How much of, you know, what phases are we in as a state as far as reopening? And who gets that? Who gets to go back to work in person and because they have the vaccine? All of that has to be worked out. And then there's also concerns about planning for the mass distribution when it does get here, that maybe we end up seeing supply chain issues like we did with PPE or testing and all of that at the beginning of the pandemic. There's a lot of stuff that still has to be worked out at this point.
I guess they should also test for antibodies, right? I mean, if you have the antibodies, you fall back in line.
I don't think that gives you a pass at this point. There's people who are being reinfected. One person right here in Seattle got two separate infections from the COVID virus. He was infected twice, months apart.
Yeah, that guy should mask up.
This plan is called, John, a living document, meaning that this is the first step. And so it's going to be evolving, changing, getting more specific or redirected as more information comes in.
Okay.
Right.
Well,
and again, a lot of that comes from the community. That's why so much of the engagement in the community is early on.
So the idea is doctors, first responders, people that are dealing most often with sick people, you take care of them first. And then the next level is anybody that would be most likely to die of this thing. And that tends to be more men than women, tends to be more black minority, overweight, secondary conditions, anybody that has a secondary condition. I guess they're not going to get down to a point where do we vaccinate the 30-year-old guy or the 82-year-old black man? Is it going to start to go, well, how much do we have invested in this one person's life and how much life does this other person have left over? We won't get into that type of rationing, right?
I would hope not. Again, with this community outreach, which the communities that have been hit really hard by the pandemic, it looks here like they're saying in their plan they are going to start a community-informed group that will figure out who in those communities who are disproportionately affected get to get that vaccine. Like, so with each phase, they're going to put some of those disproportionately affected community groups, a portion of them, in that phase, if that makes sense. So when your healthcare workers get some, we'll have some folks from the black community, a small group of them who can get them based on some decision a community panel makes at some point, it looks like.
Yeah. I saw a really cool study back in 2006. Emmanuel, what's his first name? Rahm Emanuel is his brother. This guy, in 2006, we talked about flu vaccines, and they did a study, and what they found was you can either go for mortality or you can go for transmission. So you say, the 65-year-old is less likely to have the antibodies that could help convert the vaccine into properly sort of vaccinating the individual from getting it. So rather than giving it a vaccine to the 65-year-old, give it to a 14 to 50-year-old who is more likely to possibly transmit it to the 65-year-old instead of giving it to the 65 and older, because their body isn't able to have the thing work properly through their immune system. And they did a study in 1968 in Michigan where all they did was vaccinate two groups of people. They just did school-age kids. And the school-age kids, this is the flu, which is different how it gives it, but they vaccinated just the school age kids, and the transmission was lower and less elderly people died in that community compared to the other community. So that's the difference between,
because the disease isn't out there as much because those transmitters aren't getting the vaccine.
Tom, you'll be in line. You're gonna be first in line.
Well, actually, I'd rather my mother be first in line, but you raise all sorts of really fascinating, philosophical, and troubling issues, I suppose, if we got to the point where we had to decide between saving my 89-year-old mother or saving, a 40-year-old African-American or whomever. Those kinds of choices, I think, are not going to have to be made, at least yet.
Uh-huh. No, not yet. Yes. And hopefully not in this kind of political climate, because that's just going to get out of control.
Yeah.
You can't do that equitably. And none of it's going to matter unless they get a lot more buy-in from the community than 58%. They have to have much more. That's everything the federal government says, is that everybody has to really buy in and want to get this vaccine once it's all widely available, or it's not going to work.
My guess, by the time we're into the phase two of this, after the essential people get it, and there hasn't been this bad effect, like people, you know, dropping like flies, that 58% is going to turn into 85%, you know, within the end of the year. My hunch is that most of us are going to want to get it. But I think there's a hesitation about being the first ones to get it.
Take away the politics of it. The amount of people that actually get a flu vaccine is still considerably low, considering the fact if the flu killed people like the H1N1 did, if that flu killed you, or the 1918 flu, if this flu has been coming around and it comes every single year, if it killed people, you would have more people get it. People don't get it. And the same thing will occur with this one, because COVID-19 is not as lethal for the majority of people. I'll take my risk.
But it's more transmissible. That's the concern. Like my transmissibility to my mom is more concerning to me than me getting it, for instance.
Yeah, one group can give to another group. Kids do not give to adults, but adults can give to adults.
Well, so I guess that's good. I went out and I covered the H1N1 initial vaccine, and when I was working in L.A., and the lines for that when it first came out, because that was so deadly, were astronomical.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, you see people dropping over. That killed most of the people died from that were 65 years old and younger, 80%.
Younger.
65 and younger were dying. Kids were dying of that one. It's like, whoa, I got to get something. All right. Hey, Hannah, thanks for sticking around. We appreciate it.
You bet, guys.
All right. Let's check with Tracy Taylor again, looking at traffic. All right. This is a fun story. Got to get into this quickly, Tom, with time remaining here. Steve Harpin from CBS always does a great job traveling the country and finding unusual people doing things in sweet and beautiful ways. Most often kids have teddy bears or blankets that they drag around. This kid happens to love Halloween, and more particularly, a skeleton.
It's hard being an only child.
Put the dirt in there.
Especially during a pandemic.
I got that.
Which may explain why 2-year-old Theo Brady of Salt Lake City, Utah, recently felt a strange attraction to a Halloween decoration.
I think he got kind of lonely and he found this skeleton and is like, oh, this can be my friend.
So, to placate her son, Abigail Brady agreed to something utterly ridiculous.
Like, I was just swallowed all my pride and was like, you know, if this makes my son happy, I'm going to do it.
Do what, you ask? Take them on a play date to the beach. Abigail was secretly hoping that would be the end of it. But the pair hit it off famously, and for the last month, Theo and the skeleton, who they named Benny, have been joined at the hip bone, dining together, dressing up as ghosts, and winding down at the end of a hauntingly long day.
Yeah, some weird way it's comforting. He likes to read Benny books, which is so cute and creepy, but cute.
Are you excited to take Benny to the grocery store?
Creepy, but cute. It's not exactly what most parents want for a baby's first bromance, but the bond is undeniable. No bones about it. Whether they're at the market or on the playground, if not for a lack of an epidermis, you'd swear this skeleton was Theo's brother from another mummy. In fact, at times, Benny almost seemed happy.
Look.
His humerus clearly showing. And who wouldn't want this kind of friend for their child?
He just sees the skeleton as someone that needs love.
Yeah, I think it's fine. Unless he starts walking around with a casket.
Yeah, then that's like, oh my gosh, too far.
But for now, it's nothing to be scared of.
That's okay.
In fact, this October especially, I think we could all benefit from a little less fright.
Oh.
And a lot more.
Oh, you're so nice.
Friendly.
Favorite part of that, Tom? What's your favorite part of that story?
The fact that he had to sell the climax of that story with him suggesting, well, don't carry around a coffin. Ha, ha, ha. I felt that was a cheat. How about you?
How about the skeleton in the car seat?
Yes. Okay, yeah. Oh, all right, the beach.
Cute stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought he tried way too hard.
Oh, wow.
Get
wow.
this. You're cute. Yeah. You're more into the cute than I am today. That's unusual.
Just on that one, I didn't care about this the Hartman thing. I mean, him getting in there with the pushing the casket.
Yeah.
Around.
Well, it's like a skeleton blankie. That's kind of cute,
right.
I guess.
Yeah. All right. Look at us taking it apart. How about the kid? He was cute. Good for him. He's got a friend.
Yeah.
Obviously, his humerus is showing.
All right.
A lot coming at you. Tracy Taylor with another look at traffic for us. Then we'll come back into the top of the hour. Right? Tracy?